Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to The Random Riff, a podcast about anything. I'm Sergio Barrera. Together, we'll shoot the breeze on current events, movies, books, or whatever pops to mind. There are lots of possibilities, but one guarantee. You'll be glad you tuned in. Pull up a chair, get comfortable, because here's tonight's episode of The Random Riff.
As I said, it's an Emmy and Peabody Award-winning show, and it happens to be the highest-rated show on CNN. Congratulations.
Wow, yeah.
Do you think they should add food to more of the CNN shows?
Like, yeah, like a buffet in the Situation Room.
Sure,
yeah.
Or the Situation Breakfast Nook. How did you get a gig like this? Because it sounds like a college student's dream. Like, you travel the world, yeah. You eat whatever you want, you get drunk, and you have fun, and then you go to the next place.
Yeah.
How do you land a gig like that?
I messed up in every possible way. I did everything wrong. My life was a botch. I was still dunking French fries at age 44. I screwed up magnificently. And
were you actually fleeing from the authorities? Is that how you travel?
It was a close thing. Yeah. I wrote an obnoxious book and that somehow turned into a TV show, and I started traveling, and I never looked back.
This year in the series, you're going to Cuba,
yes.
Borneo, Ethiopia, and other mysterious exotic places like Charleston, South Carolina.
Yes. A place.
I understand the locals there are just beautiful and intelligent.
It's now, awesome.
I'm from Charleston. What did you learn about Charleston on this trip? What did you do?
It's really a food capital. The food there is amazing. Mm-hmm. And
did you have hominy?
Yes.
Did you have shrimp?
Yes.
Did you have Hoppin' John?
I had all of those things, but more important than anything, I discovered the glories of the Waffle House.
That's a rare local delicacy.
This is talk about exotica. I had never been. It's apparently a place you can go, no matter how wrecked and obnoxious you are, or how late at night, they're nice to you.
Yeah, it really improves the food if it's 2 a.m. and you are hammered drunk.
I had a best time there.
The nice thing about the Waffle House is the menu is all pictures. You don't have to be able to, you don't have to read. You just go, I'll take the pretty one.
Welcome to tonight's episode of The Random Riff. My name is Sergio Barrera, and I thank you so much for being on with me tonight. On tonight's episode, we take a look back and we celebrate the life of chef and traveler Anthony Bourdain. This show is designed to be both a tribute to the life of Anthony Bourdain and also an opportunity for us here at the show to share not only his life, but also the importance of all lives. And so as we begin tonight, I'd like to start by sharing a little bit about the biographical information regarding Anthony Bourdain, because his life was one that, in his own words, he failed magnificently and ended up with a kind of life that some of us only dream about. Anthony Bourdain was raised in New Jersey, and he took interest in food, and he's often told this story. When he ate an oyster as a young boy on a trip to France with his family, he attended Vassar College for 2 years before ultimately graduating from the Culinary Institute of America in 1978. Bourdain later moved to New York City, where he ran the kitchens at a series of respected restaurants. While working as a chef, he began to try his hand at writing, which resulted in two crime novels, Bone in the Throat in 1995 and Gone Bamboo in 1997. In 1999, while he was working as the executive chef at Brasserie La Halle, Bourdain published an exposé of the restaurant industry in the New Yorker. The article was entitled Don't Eat Before Reading This, and that article became something of a cause célèbre as many of the ugly inner workings of the restaurant world were brought to light to the wider public for the first time via Bourdain's caustically witty writing. He expanded his article into the popular memoir Kitchen Confidential, Adventures in the Culinary Underbelly, published in 2000, which contained not only additional accounts of the inner workings of restaurant kitchens, but intimate details of Bourdain's personal life as well, including his long battle with heroin addiction. The memoir established Bourdain as one of the bad boys of gastronomic culture, and he parlayed his book's success into a cable television travel show called A Cook's Tour, which was broadcast between 2002 and 2003. He then took the basic concept of A Cook's Tour, Bourdain providing a humorous guide to a locale with a focus on local cuisine and offbeat cultural features, and developed it into an hour-long cable program, which we all know now as Anthony Bourdain, No Reservations. No Reservations broadcast from 2005 to 2012, and also saw his memoir adapted into a short-lived sitcom between the years of 2005 and 2006. Bourdain's newfound television fame led to frequent stints guest judging in the cooking reality show Top Chef, as well as an appearance on The Simpsons. He later launched another travel show, The Layover, which broadcast from 2011 to 2013, which centered on Bourdain spending between 24 to 48 hours in a select destination. In 2013 to 2015, he was a judge on the cooking competition program The Taste, and his other TV credits include the travel show Anthony Bourdain, Parts Unknown, which won multiple Emmy Awards for Outstanding Informational Series, as well as earning him a Peabody Award in 2014. In addition to Kitchen Confidential, Bourdain's writings include A Cook's Tour, In Search of the Perfect Meal, The Nasty Bits, Collected Varietal Cuts, Usable Trims, Scraps and Bones, Medium Raw, A Bloody Valentine to the World of Food and the People Who Cook, and another foray into crime fiction in 2001 called Bobby Gold. All of his writings in some way, shape, or form received recognition and awards. And of course, he also contributed to the world of culinary books by publishing a cookbook called Appetites in 2016. To look at his biography is to see a man who overcame so many things and so many dark places to become one of the leading voices of our time, not only the culinary world, but in the world of getting to know what this world, our world, was really all about. Tonight here on The Random Riff, I'd like to take some time to talk to a few friends and just find out what was it about Anthony Bourdain, who we lost this past week to suicide, that impacted us all. This show is a celebration. And while, of course, there will be moments of grief and mourning, I'd like to think that those of us who are going to participate in this journey tonight will agree that Anthony Bourdain would want us to laugh, have a good time, and celebrate more so than be sad. Joining me first this evening is a very good friend of mine, Bud Monofelt. A lot of folks know him as Captain Motorboater. And tonight, Bud, as we begin our conversation, first of all, thanks so much for taking the time to be with me here this evening.
Hey, man, thanks for having me on. Great topic, obviously. Some, you know, you and I share a lot of similar backgrounds in our love for food and travel, and there's no better flag bearer for that, you know, love than Anthony Bourdain, in my opinion. So, you know, it's suicide. I don't know. We'll start off on just super dark note there, but suicide has taken away a lot of loved ones from a lot of people, but it sure has taken away a lot of my heroes growing up, you know, in recent years and in years past. But, you know, one of my musical heroes growing up was, you know, in a graduate of high school in the 90s, and I was all about the grunge era music and losing, you know, Kurt Cobain and to suicide, you know, in the middle of his greatness, and, you know, losing Chris from Soundgarden recently and Chester from Linkin Park and Anthony Bourdain. It's just, you know, it's this silent monster that's out in the world that takes so many people from us, and it's such a hard thing to wrap around your head around something so personal. And so, you know, just
no, and go ahead. I'm sorry.
Answerless. You know what I mean? There's like, how do you prevent or stop something that you can't control because the people who are in control of, you know, themselves are not in control of themselves. It's crazy, but I don't even know where to start with how much influence like Anthony Bourdain has had in my life, though, you know?
And I just want to say, but I think that we're on, you know, I like the fact that you start with what I think is you know, too many times the treated as the elephant in the room. You know, I know exactly where I was the moment I found out that Bourdain had had passed, and then subsequently finding out that it was by suicide. It, you know, you can't wrap your head around it. And so, you know, as we proceed through tonight, it's going to be a topic that we'll discuss, and it's going to be an opportunity for us to use this platform to help people and give resources and encouragement. But you're right. I mean, I think of all the people that you named, I literally can tell you remembering exactly where I was when I heard about Kurt Cobain, when I heard about Chris Cornell, and we'll talk later about, you know, why celebrity connection is why it even happens. And when something like this occurs and one of those celebrities that we find near and dear decides to go this path, why it's so impactful. As we get started, Bud, tell us a little bit about how did you even come across Anthony Bourdain? It's a story that I know I love to hear and I'll share as well, but how were you first exposed to this culinary giant that we know and love?
Well, I've been into cooking pretty much my whole life. I learned to cook at a young age, and never once considering cooking as a career. Cooking was a way to, you know, survive, right? Like I was a latchkey kid, so I had to learn how to fend for myself and create meals. And, you know, there were plenty of things to eat in the house, but I had no idea how to put them together until I started to, you know, read recipe books and get recipes that my parents had, my grandparents had, and just start messing around with stuff. And when, you know, cable TV started to have cooking shows on, you know, I was too young for like the Julia Child stuff. And I never got into that whole thing. But when, you know, cooking shows or cable shows completely dedicated to cooking, right, you know, Food Network and whatnot, just blew my mind. I could sit there all day and watch and learn, basically go to college or go to culinary school on TV. And I feel like that's what I did for most of my adolescence and adult, you know, young adult life, falling, you know, into deep state of education Brown. And then, you know, he was really my first culinary hero. And then the explosion of Emeril Lagasse and his whole, you know, let's take it to another level and throw some entertainment into this whole cooking stuff caught my eye. And then the show comes on with this skinny, you know, weird-looking, kind of gangly a-hole called No Reservations. And I was like, what is this guy all about? You know, he's the opposite of Emeril, Mr. Nice Guy. Let me feed you, you know, let me give, you know, an ice cream cone to the little kid in the front row while I'm making some sort of everything looks alike gumbo. Right. I think that's only, that's all, it seems like all he ever made. But he had plenty of his, you know, Emeril spice all over it. That's for sure. And then you got Anthony Bourdain. Probably like push the kid off of the, you know, front row and take his ice cream from him. You know, I'm like, this dude is like punk rock. I gotta figure out what he's got going on. So I you know, totally watched every episode of No Reservations 1,000 times. And
yeah,
here's a guy that was not only.
All right, we seem to have lost a connection with Bud, so we'll hope to get him back on as we, you know, continue and wait for that to occur. I know for myself, I first was exposed to Anthony Bourdain through No Reservations, early episodes of the show that I know I came across and was in the same way that Bud was describing. I was just amazed at this punk rock attitude that Anthony Bourdain brought to his show, but also, of course, the passion for food that that he had. And as he produced every episode, again, I hadn't yet seen a Cook's Tour. I kind of did that backwards because No Reservations was what introduced me to Tony Bourdain. I just fell in love with that show. And as that experience continued, as I watched more and more episodes, I, of course, began to look for his books and material that he'd written. That's how I was actually introduced to Kitchen Confidential. And having read that book, I'm a guy who in my past life, I by no means claim to be a chef of any type of skill or note, but I know that there was a point in my life where I decided to sort of forage into the chef world by taking a 1 week culinary training course that allowed me to become a personal chef, and was actually able to do some work for some clients in which I was able to actually cook for them. And I share all that because there was enough of a connection in my experience that allowed me to relate in a small bit to the book and what was being described in Kitchen Confidential. And of course, Bourdain brought so much more to it in that experience. And once I read that book, I couldn't do anything but continue to find every bit of material he had written, including his books that were the fictional books that he wrote. They were actually crime novels. And so, you know, as my experience expanded in getting to know his material, like anybody else, No Reservations was the show that really launched it. You know, but as we get you back on here, you know, we're talking about a show like No Reservations, and the fact that we can watch those episodes over and over and over. It was that punk rock attitude. It was that sort of no holds barred, unapologetic approach. I mean, this was one of the most beeped shows that I'd ever seen on cable TV.
And the genius of it really is, it felt like he literally could do whatever he wanted with that show. The way he was allowed to tell stories, the way he was allowed to portray wherever he was, whatever, you know, paintbrush he wanted to paint the place he was visiting or the food he was eating, it always felt like he was allowed to do it his way. He wasn't getting a narrative from the network or a narrative from the Chamber of Commerce. You know, don't put us in this kind of light, or even governments to that extent.
Yeah.
It always felt like he was allowed to paint it with his brush, you know?
Yeah, and you know, you bring up an interesting point, because one of the reasons that A Cook's Tour lasted for such a short time, it was originally broadcast on the Food Network. A Cook's Tour was actually his first show based on the book he wrote, which was a series of vignettes describing places he'd visited to that point. This was very, very early in his career. But as his career progressed into No Reservations and beyond, he had no shortage of words for describing how A Cook's Tour for him was not the best experience because of what you're talking about. He wasn't given free range. He was given a template to have to follow. And all you have to do is watch anything between No Reservations and Parts Unknown and know that that's not what you do to a Bourdain. You have to just let him be himself, you know.
His narrative is what keeps you engaged. He wants you to look at things, you know, in a specific way for a specific reason. And if you don't let him have that type of freedom to paint that picture and to deliver that narrative, then he's just a voice. He's just describing, you know, he's an announcer for all intents and purposes. So then the brilliance to get involved with CNN. And he said, you know, you can only get so far when your name badge has, you know, Travel Network on it or Food Network on it. But when your badge says CNN, the amount of doors that it opens and the accessibility that you now have to countries that you never had access to before, to parts of countries you never had access to anymore. And obviously, I'm sure the budget's a little bit better over at CNN.
It definitely opened up, I think you would agree, we even see a distinct difference between No Reservations and Parts Unknown. Parts Unknown became even grittier. It became even more. I hate to say it became less about the food, because the food was the thread that bound everything, but it was more about the human condition. Parts Unknown really resonated with me because it really was Bourdain's reaching his full potential as not only a chef, but more importantly as someone who understood that food is a connector of humanity. And if that's the case, and if that's your gig in terms of that's what gets you to places and has you travel to places, then you have a right to speak about the humanity that you encounter. And so as much as I love No Reservations, Parts Unknown took it to a whole nother level and became a more complete experience that I think really, really drove him to do as much as he was doing and to travel to all the places he could. I mean, come on, he filmed an entire episode in Cuba, which prior to that, of course, had been inaccessible. He went to places that were seemingly unreachable to do one thing, to eat, to live, and to talk about the human condition.
And so many in insanely tense episodes on both shows. You know, the famous Beirut episode. You know, that if you're not aware of the episode, please find that as soon as you can and watch it, because the tense situations that they are in during that episode, and yet they still find a way to
It's a situation where the episode itself is, again, it becomes less about food and enjoyment than it is about the people and the condition of the country at the time. And so, yeah, it really does impact. I really think that show is what launched the ability for Bourdain to know that he was a voice that was being listened to, that was being heard, and that really had a lot more to say than just about places to visit and places to eat. And so, yeah, that's the thing that I know I came out of that episode with, you know, just really, really an impactful episode. And so, yeah, going to check back to see if we got our friend Bud on the line still. And as we continue this tribute, there are several other folks who will be joining us this evening. I'll be talking to just friends of mine. And you know, if you've not listened to the show before, the Random Riff here, we love to converse about anything and everything. And it's about the things that that I know I love to talk about and that my friends love to talk about. And so tonight we'll be joined by a few folks who I know and love. Some of you know them from the roller derby world, and they have a lot to say about the man that we knew as Anthony Bourdain. And so as we continue our conversation, we'll take a moment to take a little bit of a break. And I'd like to play a clip talks about, or that's related to Anthony Bourdain's favorite place that he visited over the years, and the experiences that he had. Vietnam was always a place that Anthony Bourdain was transported to, and you know, not just literally, but figuratively. He always spoke very highly of his trips there. And when you watch episodes of either No Reservations or Parts Unknown, where he is in Vietnam, you can really, really sense the love and connection that he has to that place. So we'll take a break, and we'll take a listen to Bourdain talking about Vietnam. We'll be right back here on The Random Riff.
As with a love affair, you don't really realize you've fallen in love until it's too late. So it's after the fact. I mean, I'm sure, you know, I fell in love with Vietnam on one trip, and I think it was only on a return trip that I realized that I was a goner. So I went first time to South Vietnam, made very good friends, immediately recognized this incredibly beautiful country filled with proud cooks and passionate eaters, a place that looked and felt just like the movies, which is of course what I very much wanted, yet better. A place that still evoked Graham Greene, Graham Greene's Quiet American, you know, still all those years later. But it was when I went back a second time with my crew, Chris and Lydia, we all went back, and I'll never forget, we got off the plane, just walked out of the airport to get in the car. As we're heading into Hanoi, we all burst into tears. I mean, we're all weeping. It was just so, so visceral a reaction. We were all so grateful. It was so beautiful. It was so good to be back. Why Vietnam? Again, like falling in love, you know. You described the first woman you ever fell in love. Why did you fall in love? I mean, you can say because she's beautiful, she's funny, she's brilliant, you know, she can, you know, take my 68 Shelby Cobra apart and reconstruct it to factory specs in, you know, 45 minutes. But the fact is that it's none of those things. It's something else. It's maybe pheromonic. It's magic, and it's probably best to not try and figure it out.
Welcome back to the Random Riff. Anthony Bourdain speaking about his love for Vietnam. And as I mentioned before, that clip, if you really want to see a guy who is in a place that he absolutely adores and loves to share, catch any of his episodes of either A Cook's Tour, No Reservations, or Parts Unknown, where he's in Vietnam. But any favorite episodes or any episodes that stand out to you over the time that you watched his work?
The Ukraine,
yeah,
was such a flaming dumpster fire. That one is hilarious. I'll watch that anytime it's on. Huge fan of the Beirut episode, the Vietnam episode, Cuba. Jersey is great, especially from the Parts Unknown catalog, because he's a New Jersey guy. And he takes it away from that whole, Jersey Shore pumped up Guido into the, real people of the Jersey Shore that, you know, he worked a lot of restaurants in that area before he got into the city. He has a lot of passion, obviously, from being that guy from Jersey. He hangs out with a lot of his friends who are from Jersey. Recently, I really enjoyed, what was it? I'm having a brain cramp real quick. Armenia. That was a great episode. Especially, I think that there are so many Americans that have no idea what the Armenian people went through with the, basic genocide by the, almost completely eradicated from the planet. And now you have what is a pretty darn cool thriving country that has a lot of mixed culture in it from what's around it, and obviously almost being eliminated. He spends a lot of time with Serge Tankian from System of a Down on that episode too. And this weird connection that Armenians have with Los Angeles. It was a place where a lot of Armenians ended up throughout time and have built great communities and culture in those in that city. I can think of a million things. What would be a more interesting question that I honestly couldn't answer, so don't ask it, but is there an episode I don't like, right? Like, have you ever watched an episode where I was like, meh, that was weak?
I could have done without that one. I know I can't certainly say that. One of the things that I was always attracted to in terms of his shows was the people he would spend time with. I think of episodes that he visited with people like Ted Nugent. Those were some of the most intense episodes. He also would spend a lot of time with Zamir, who was one of the more
greatest.
greatest co-host ever. Any episode with him is you got to watch more than once. But for me, I was always geeked whenever he had Michael Ruhlman on. Ruhlman is a food author that is just in the culinary world is held in very high regard. And Michael Ruhlman was sort of the anti-Bourdain in that he was a lot less rock and roll. He was a lot less punk rock for sure. But he definitely knew his way around the culinary world. And so whenever they would be together, it would be awesome watching Bourdain taking him places like Skyline Chili. You know, here's a guy who, Ruhlman, who not only wrote some of the most definitive works of, regarding food, he himself put himself through the Culinary Institute of America's training program just to experience it and be able to write about it. So this is the guy who has done it all in terms of understanding food and understanding its background. And here Bourdain takes him to places like Skyline Chili, which I got to experience last year in Ohio. And I was like, I get it. Like, I totally understand why Bourdain favors these kind of things. You know, Bourdain's favorite burger place, he said, was In-N-Out. So, you know, right. There was always that. I always loved the interactions he had with people.
Every Texan just cringed right now when he said that.
Yeah, I know.
they just dismissed him completely. That guy knows nothing.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
You know, and I think what anybody, a fan of his, will tell you that the thing they appreciate the most isn't the knowledge of food or his, you know, opening up the idea that you should eat this or should eat that. It's the knowledge that food gets you into a conversation with somebody that you never expected to get. And it could happen at the finest eating establishment in the world, or it can happen at Waffle House, right? There is no rule of engagement when it comes to opening up your mind to cultural experience using food as the, you know, as the reason.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, when you talk about the kind of experiences he's had, and, you know, I the reason I bring up In-N-Out was because it was always so funny to me that he could love food anywhere. But then I know some of the episodes that stood out to me was, you know, he was there for the final meal that was ever prepared at El Bulli, Ferran Adrià's place in Spain.
Mm-hmm.
He visited Thomas Keller at the French Laundry. These are people who I hold as culinary heroes, and I include Bourdain. You know, Bourdain himself would never put himself in that culinary elite, but he earned a place at that table because people like Keller and people like Adrià and, you know, José Andrés and so many other chefs, they understood his respect and his love for food and for the culinary experience. And so it was great to see him interact with people like that, because that really stoked my love of being adventurous with food. And you know, it was a constant reminder to me whenever I would watch his shows that you got to live life and you got to eat well. And, you know, it just, there wasn't a single episode, like you said, that I didn't come away with something. All of them were very impactful.
I had for dinner tonight a tamale burrito from Tommy Tamale.
And I was like, yeah.
So that it almost, you know, without a guy like Anthony Bourdain having a show like he has, or a guy like Andrew Zimmern having a show like he has, I don't think people are shoving tamales in burritos and selling them in stores, right?
Yeah.
But that exists. I was able to eat that because of guys like that. And, if Anthony Bourdain had eaten that, he would have lost his mind and fallen in love, because it's so decadent and criminal. But this whole – our whole country looks at food differently, looks at what they eat regionally and culturally, and has access to food that they never had access to before because of guys like Anthony Bourdain and Andrew Zimmern making that available for us to see that it can exist, that it is out there, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
I mean, that in itself is a legacy and a gift that I don't know how you ever repay somebody for, you know?
Yeah, indeed. Now, that's the thing, is his legacy will be it's set. It's there. Reading recently that Netflix, the No Reservations, the Parts Unknown episodes were actually due to be off of Netflix this Saturday. And, you know, the decision was made, we're going to keep these episodes on. And one of the comments that was made was, you know, this is about furthering someone's legacy and knowing that people need to see his work. And so I'm thankful we get to have that and continue to encourage people to check it out. I was talking to my friend Nick Kramer, you know, frequent co-host with me here, and he watched the first episode of No Reservations. He discovered it, you know, as a result of all this this past week, and he's just floored by it, and is going to continue watching. And that's my hope, is that what we do tonight, which will include so much more, we'll begin by helping to share with people his legacy and to know that together we can keep his passion alive by making it our own. So Bud, thanks so much for being on tonight and for sharing this time with us. I think that tamale burrito, I'm going to raise you with a glass of scotch and say a toast to our friend Anthony Bourdain. Whether we knew him personally or not, I know that we know we felt like we did. So thanks for being on.
I appreciate it. You know, I appreciate being on your show. I appreciate having the opportunity to talk about one of my true, you know, actual celebrity heroes. I don't have many, and now I have one less, sadly. But, yeah. You know, let's keep talking about him as long as we can, because I think he's a true national treasure. And, somebody that's going to still in his legacy keep us all from, you know, destroying ourselves, because he understands how to unite people through food. So thanks, buddy. I appreciate you having me on.
Absolutely. Well, once again, we're talking to Anthony Bourdain here on the Random Riff. I'd like to now turn to a special segment that I was able to tape recently. Good friends of mine, Jake Alfred Potter and Leslie Jones. Some of you know them from the roller derby world. And they joined me yesterday so we could continue this discussion and to share our thoughts on someone who we all knew as a culinary giant, but also as someone who brought the world together. So here's my talk with Jake and Leslie here on the Random Riff. Welcome back to this evening's episode, our tribute to Anthony Bourdain here on the Random Riff. I am joined now by writer and football coach Jake Potter, good friend of the show. We had him on a previous episode of the A Few Minutes With podcast. Jake, thank you so much for joining here this evening.
Thank you so much for having me. It's always a privilege.
Absolutely. We're glad to have you. And also joining me is Leslie Jones from the roller derby world known as Honky Tonka. Leslie, thanks so much for taking time to meet with us tonight.
Thank you. It's an honor to be here.
And as you know, we decided to take some time out of the show that we're doing here to focus on the memories and impacts and such that Anthony Bourdain played in our lives. Earlier tonight, we talked about a bit of his life and history, and so far the folks that we've talked to have really shared sort of the impacts that he had. For me, it was really a lot about inspiring me to travel and, you know, eat and explore foods, but also I think in large part just live well, and that's something that I know has become a theme to me. So I'm curious, Leslie, if we don't mind, we'll start with you. You know, talk a little bit about, you know, what it was about Bourdain that, you know, impacted you or played a role in your connection with him.
Mine, I wish I had found him earlier. About 4 years ago, a friend of mine that's been following his whole career introduced him into my life with the Parts Unknown series. And I was the minute I started watching it, I was like, I want to be friends with this guy. Like, I want to know this guy. I want to be this guy. And it made me kind of, especially now, wish I had known him longer. Not that it would have made it, mostly just because then I would feel more a part of it. I wanted so badly just to know more. His attitude on everything, not just food and travel, but just with life, because they all kind of tie in together, I think. Yeah. And it made me want to be him. It made me want to know him. It made me want to go just do what he was doing and see those things through his eyes like he did on his show. And
yeah.
I would, and even now it makes me, it's left me wanting more. Like even now reading all the stuff I didn't know before that has come out in the, about his earlier life or his life in general. And it's crazy for a man that I only knew really through a TV screen made me feel so much. But I think it takes a really special person to do that.
Yeah. No, indeed. I think you echo a lot of thoughts that I know I've heard from folks. And so it's hard to pinpoint, you know, what it is about an individual that that has that kind of impact from such a from a distance, I guess, is the best way to put it. But I totally understand that. So Jake, your thoughts, initially on Bourdain and how did he come into your universe?
I'm greatly upset by the passing of Bourdain. For his presence in my life has been multifolded. I first came into realizing who he was in 2005 when Fox aired a sitcom with Bradley Cooper called Kitchen Confidential, which is loosely based on Bourdain's book. And this show, Bradley Cooper's playing basically Anthony Bourdain in a comedy setting. And it just goes through what happens in you know, big name kitchens in New York City. And from there, I was able to like learn who Anthony Bourdain was. And his struggles with addiction really called out to me because I struggle with an addiction similar to Mr. Bourdain's. And so what the biggest thing I took from him was you can get clean and sober and you can pursue your passions despite having this monkey on your back, for lack of a better term.
Yeah.
And his passions were just absolutely amazing. And if anyone who had lived through their passions, it was Bourdain. And that's what inspired me to go and pursue the things I wanted to pursue, whether it was writing or athletics or whatever like it may be. Another thing about him that really struck me was his pure honesty. You always knew what he thought about someone or something. And if his humor got any drier, he was going to be a British comedian. but he, you know, you knew where you stood with the guy. And if he liked something, he showered it with praise. And if he hated it, oh God, did you know? And, you know, having spent 17 years in New Orleans, it was commonplace to go walking through various parts of the city and see Tony Bourdain walking in or out of a restaurant. Or, you know, there's the Big Easy Roller Girls, my former league, just shared pictures of him on his show wearing a Big Easy Roller Girls t-shirt. So his love of New Orleans really became a matter of pride for New Orleanians. And I think, you know, they removed the statue of Robert E. Lee at Lee Circle. I wouldn't be surprised if some New Orleanian had petitioned to put a statue of Bourdain up there. But it's a tremendous loss. And it's the little things he did. You know, there's the now famous video of him having cold noodles with Barack Obama sitting on plastic stools in Vietnam. That's, you get these insanely human moments from somebody who seems larger than life, and it's awe-inspiring.
Yeah. No, definitely. And you know, the thing I think that has been a recurring theme in all of what I've read and the time that I know, you know, I was exposed to him, is that honesty that you talk about. That's what you always knew you got from Bourdain, is an honest assessment. I mean, all you have to do is I was doing some perusing on YouTube the other day, and he has a lot to say about certain people in the culinary world, and some good, some bad. You know, he had some famous issues with Paula Deen, for example. And I was able to see him actually, he did a tour where he did a sort of one-man show kind of thing where he talked about his travels and he talked about some of his pet peeves when it came to food and food celebrity and such. And, you know, it was just, like you said, you always knew where you stood with him and you always knew what his opinions were. He didn't hedge anything of what he said. It was always very direct. And you know, it's funny, Leslie, because one of the things I think about when Jake was talking was that's kind of how I know you to be. You're very straightforward and you you tell it like it is. And so that must have been a part of him that appealed to you individually.
Well, first, that gave me goosebumps. Thank you. Yes, I would think that I feel like it almost inspires me to be that authentic of a person as much as you can. I wish I could even, I don't think I could ever measure up. I wish I could be what he did. Like, I wish I could be that blunt and straightforward and almost courageous in a lot of sense. Like, the people that he so blatantly called out, especially when they did something wrong, you know?
Yeah.
And then tried to maybe cover it or tried to make, like, a push it under the rug. And he was like, no, it was always, no, you did this. You pay the consequences for it. And yeah. Especially as a woman, like when his current wife was very, a big advocate in the Me Too movement. And
right.
He stood so staunchly beside her. As a woman, it's heartfelt. It's appreciated. It makes you wish, it makes you appreciate the advocate that he was and in a way will always be because things that he said so publicly.
Yeah. No, absolutely. It's hard not to, to spend time looking through just a huge litany of quotes that came from this man.
Yeah.
And, you know, I'm going to read one to you guys and I'm going to ask you guys to comment on sort of how it resonates or what your thoughts are. He was quoted as saying, as you move through this life and this world, you change things slightly. You leave marks behind, however small. And in return, life and travel leaves marks on you. Most of the times, those marks on your body or on your heart are beautiful. Often, though, they hurt. One of the things that I know I thought when I found out the news about his passing and that it was suicide was to wonder if, you know, if you followed his shows, and I've been watching him since he did a Cook's Tour years and years ago on the Food Network and all the way through No Reservations and Into Parts Unknown. And I mean, just episode after episode, here's a man who saw the world in all of its detail. If you watched episodes of his shows, then you know he didn't go to the glamorous places. He didn't go
yeah.
where the tourists went. He was all about go where the locals go. And as his career progressed even further, he became more about go where the real is. It wasn't about glamorizing a city or a town. It was about enjoying its food, but then learning about its culture, its people, its politics. And I just wondered, there was a point initially where I was like, that had to have taken a toll because he saw so much of the real day in and day out. What are your thoughts on that quotation and how does it speak to you?
I'll let Jake go first. I like listening
okay.
to Jake.
you know, I feel it kind of, it hits deep. You know, every interaction we have leaves a mark, and he's absolutely right. And I think as humans, we are more conditioned to learn through pain than anything else. And what strikes me about those words from Bourdain is it's coming from someone who has hurt so much. And I wonder if he insisted on going to those parts of the world that don't get the spotlight, that aren't considered glamorous, because of whatever inadequacies he may have felt within himself. Or he may have wanted to, and I think this might be the more honest thing, is he might want to show that what makes humanity and life so beautiful are the flaws and are the tragic parts, the marks that we want to hide. At least that's what I believe. You know, we spend so much time trying to fit in with everyone else and be like somebody else. We don't celebrate what makes us different from one another and find ways to accept those differences. And I think if Bourdain's going to leave a lasting legacy, it would be that.
Yeah. Leslie, your thoughts?
There's a lot that I agree with what Jake said. I also see it from, I work in the tourism industry, and I'm more on the showcase side because I promote where I live as a destination. So I appreciate his want and ability to showcase the not so pretty sides of where he goes, because I firmly believe community truly tells the story of where you're going or where you're visiting or what your destination is. And there are really pretty parts of that story, you know, and tourism tends to only want to show you the really, really pretty parts. And some of those parts are kind of fake. They're like, really nasty fondant on the cake. Like, it's really pretty, but it's not a lot of depth there. And it's not, and those are kind of like, they're really like tourist traps and things like that. But inside, and you dig a little bit deeper, you go a little bit further down the street, you go a little bit further on down the river, there's these, you know, businesses and families and restaurants that have legacies and stories that have helped build the city or town or, you know, country, whatever, and those are the stories like I want to hear, especially as someone in tourism, because I believe tourism is really about storytelling, and his ability to take and go to sometimes very poverty-ridden places and write a beautiful story about those places that elicit this want to be able to still want to go there is amazing and profound, and those stories deserve to be told, and he did it in a beautiful way, and he paid so much homage and respect to it, and especially since it was all very centered around food, because so much happens around food, you know, and I think that's and I feel like I got off topic from this quote, from all that. But
no,
his quote, I think surmises, like, because he saw things that weren't fair and weren't right and were ugly and not pretty and something very little that you're going to be able to, you can't fix because you have to leave. But he shone a light on them. And then he also did it in a way where it wasn't that you felt sorry for them.
Right.
You didn't pity.
Yeah, he did it with dignity.
Yeah, and I find a huge amount of respect in that and appreciation, because that's the parts of tourism I like being a part of.
Yeah, I know that we would be remiss if we didn't the three of us look at one of his most famous quotations about food. And I think we all know his work enough to know that if we kept it just to the sad feeling of that we go through in moments like this, he would probably be the first to kick us in the ass. And so he was always about, you know, using humor to sort of make his points and such. And so I definitely want us to spend some time thinking about the following quote. He said, "Good food and good eating are about risk." I'm always curious how much the work that he did, whether it was his books. I had the fortune of reading all of his books and watching his shows. That material was so key to my adventurous nature when it comes to food. Can you think of anything that you tried as a result of watching him, or what are your thoughts on the whole notion of eating well is sometimes about risk? I mean, Jake, get us started. You know, does that resonate with you?
It does. I am not an adventurous eater by nature. I'm very, very picky. And So when I moved to Minneapolis, there's a variety of ethnic foods here, and there's a lot of Ethiopian food. And my partner, they love Ethiopian food. And so we went to an Ethiopian restaurant, and Cody ordered piles and piles of this food, and there's not silverware in sight. And I don't know what the hell I'm supposed to do, because I'm a white kid from the city. And so I'm just eating this glop, and like, I didn't bother to ask what it was, but it tasted fantastic. And to this day, I have no idea what I ingested. I don't want to know, but it was delicious. And yeah. It was like, I think maybe Bourdain had some influence on that, where it's like you eat what's put in front of you. You know, it's impolite not to eat what's given to you. And Bourdain was all about that. Like, you know, you go to the cultures you're in and you eat what they offer. And so this was me choosing something new. And I've been a little more adventurous since then. I've discovered I like Indian food. My stomach doesn't, but I do. So it's, you know, the adventurous eating is there. And then, you know, when you're having fun eating, you open up with people. Like, that's why going out on a dinner date is such a great icebreaker, such a great thing, because you let your guard down when you're eating.
Yeah.
And I think Bourdain was on to something with that.
Absolutely. Leslie, what about you? Are you adventurous when it comes to food?
I, like Jake, I had to also learn to be an adventurous eater. I was born, my derby name is Honky Tonka, and I come from some true rednecks that were quite very, like, meat and potatoes, and you eat a piece of bread at every meal, but nothing strays out of meat and potatoes. Like, it's, or it's very traditional Mexican food.
Right.
So it wasn't, like, I didn't get introduced to a whole world of food until I left home. And it was scary because it was like, what if I don't like it? And then if I'm spending money on it, I don't have a lot of money. I don't want to not like what I eat. So yeah. I had to slowly, I grew into being a more adventurous eater. I would say I was well on my way to being more adventurous when I found Anthony Bourdain. But he definitely encouraged me to embrace that risk, because sometimes it's not great. Sometimes you want it to be good and it's not, and that sucks. But it is all part of, like, the adventure, right? And then you get to say that you tried that. And then you'll always remember, whether you loved it or hate it, you will always remember whatever it was that was happening. And I definitely appreciate the encouragement. Because there's a whole world out there to, like, taste and smell, and it's, I want to at least know as much of it as I can.
Right. Yeah, that's that's one of the things that I know I have had the fortune of you know, going into a place in life where I started to be adventurous about food, because I live under the premise that you know, this, you only go, you only have this one time, you know, around the sun, and he inspired a lot of us to not just eat well, but also to travel and to see the world. And I know, you know, we all have roller derby in common, and you guys know how far it's taken me in terms of the places I go. I mean, I was in Okinawa, Japan last year, I was there for derby, but I'm not gonna lie, I was there for food. And I can tell you that I was sitting in a ramen shop and with a very dear friend of mine, and, you know, having my very first bowl of ramen, authentic ramen there, you know, and I literally had this moment where I'm like, I think this is what he feels like. I really do. I do feel like this is my own sort of Bourdain moment that I felt. Yeah. I, you know, because it was a bowl of soup with a friend, and it was the most amazing introduction to, because it was literally, I landed and I was taken to go eat, and that was my introduction to my almost 7 days in Japan. And it started over a bowl of soup, of food, you know. And so I literally was like, okay, for just a brief moment, I believe that this is what it must be like for him, because there's no frills about it. And you're not only are you bonding over food, but you're on the cusp of this adventure. For me, Japan, for you guys, whatever it might be. And that's, I think, what for me the legacy will be, is that he furthered my notion that life has to be lived. You can't just let it pass you by. You've got to eat that food. You've got to travel that to that destination, not just because it's there, but because there's people there. There are experiences to be had. And I know that's the you know, when it talks, you know, when he talks about eating great food is sometimes a risk. I have found that the risk is always worth taking, because you almost always get to share it with somebody. It's not so much about the food as it is about the contact.
You know, when, one of the things that strikes me about you in particular, Sergio, there isn't a week that goes by that since I've had you access to you on social media where you don't post a picture of food and I say, dear God, I want to eat that.
Right? Me too.
So, like, I want you to know, like, in your own Tony Bourdain way, you're still exposing people to food and the places you go. Like, I look forward to hearing, you know, Piggy Fatness's travels, because there's always a food post. And it's like, I'm in that part of the country, I need to go to that restaurant.
Yeah, I second
I think, you know, you need, like, stamps that say, you know, Sergio Barrera endorses this place. Because the Derby community alone will follow and go to where you eat.
Yeah. Well, I'm so happy to hear you say that, because I'm one of those that every time I post a food picture, in my own head, I'm like, at some point people are going to be like, enough already. But
no,
you know, I've gotten more positive response.
There are people that are bad at it. There are people that are bad at packing food posts, because they usually come off really braggy, and it's more about where they are and not what they're eating. But, like, you know that you love, like, you love food when you post. Like, and the people that love food also know that you love food. So you are doing it right.
Well, I appreciate that.
Yeah, you live for the experience. And, you know, it's – I imagine going out to dinner with you is a fun thing, and it's honestly on my bucket list of things to do before I die.
I've gone to eat lunch with him, and it was one of my favorite lunches. So I attest to that.
Well, thank you. And that's the thing is, you know, when I watch the work that he did, that Bourdain did, and you know, the hardest thing in the world this past weekend was to be doing the things that he inspired me to do, knowing that he wasn't of this world anymore. Because this whole weekend was travel and food and Derby, yes. And I don't want to in any way diminish the value of the Derby experience, because it was two of the most beautiful experiences I've had. But I remember, you know, that was such an escape from the grief and the mourning, because I was doing that thing that he inspired me to do. And it was tough, because in the quiet moments in the car, you can play any podcast, you can listen to any music, but the idea kept coming back to me. And I thought, you know what, this weekend, I'm going to eat well, you know. And I came out of this experience with a pork chop, a simple pork chop, that I sat there stunned at how delicious it was. And how much like pork other pork chops in my life have not tasted, you know? it was literally that sort of experience of like, I think I finally discovered what a pork chop's supposed to taste like. And so everything resonated a lot deeper, because I have been so inspired to travel and to eat well and to share with people, because I could keep it all to myself. But I share it because I want other people to experience it. And I think that's something that we probably all do in a small way. And I think it's something that, you know, amongst the other ways in which Bourdain impacted us, I know for me, I got through the weekend because I was doing what he inspired me to do. And this show is part of my process of accepting what's happened and trying to figure out how can we use this moment to help other people, you know? And so I know I'm going on a bit of a tangent, but guys, you're part of the process of helping not just me, but a lot of other people cope, and we help each other. But this loss is one that I'm not going to be able to move past too soon. But at the very least, I can say that I'm doing the things that Anthony Bourdain inspired me to do, and I can share that with people. And I know that you guys will do the same.
Yes, and I think it's important to also take it a step further. And like, I encourage your listeners, and I know this is probably going to be said multiple times throughout this episode, but if you are struggling with depression or suicidal thoughts, you're not alone, and there is always someone who you can reach out to. Like, you know, Sergio has offered, I'm here staying on this program. You find me. I will listen to you all night as long as it takes. Bourdain suffered, and he did something irreversible. And I just don't want anyone else to go through that.
Yeah. No.
I would echo that as well. I'm also not sitting here not wanting to help someone. I just wanted to put, I am here as well. But I would also say that for it, check, like there was a post made that day, and it was just check on your strong friends. And yeah. I had a friend of mine that I hadn't talked to in a couple of days reach out to me and tell me that's why she reached out to me to check on me, was because of that post. And it touched me very deeply, because one, to think it was that they thought I was a strong person. Two, also knowing that I struggle with depression, and I know I am terrible for asking for help, especially at the darkest times. And yeah. It was nice to be thought of and checked on. And and that goes for, and it was something that resounded in me to be more resilient in checking on my friends as well.
Yeah.
Because we all have our stuff that we go home to that we don't unpack for everyone else.
Yeah.
No, that's definitely true. So, well, you know, as we begin to wrap up this portion of the conversation, number one, first, guys, thank you so much. I mean, you guys, you two know, I love you dearly. And, you know, I know that all of us, in different ways, are reacting and you know, moving through this experience, but, I was very pleased. I want to tell you guys both so that everyone can hear. I was very pleased to know that two of my favorite people were also fans, and I'm excited that not only are we going to get to use this as a way to you know, celebrate the life of Anthony Bourdain, who we all admired, but also, as you guys just said, to use it as a way to put a message out that says you're not alone. And the lesson, I think, for me too, Leslie, based on what you're saying, is I can tell people to come talk to me. And Jake, I know you agree with this, but, you know, sometimes it's about reaching out ourselves. And I know that that's not something I thought about before that post that you were talking about, Leslie, mm-hmm. I'm not good necessarily at expressing myself when it comes to helping people. I tell people I've got broad shoulders and I've got good ears, and I may not mm-hmm. have the advice or I may not have the right message, but if I learned a lesson in this, it's that I should seek out others just to make sure they're okay, versus thinking that, hey, my offering of these shoulders and ears is going to be enough, you know? And I think that for me is the lasting message that you and I and others can carry forward. But it's the passion that Bourdain showed in his entire life that I want him remembered for. It isn't about this final act. It's about everything that he did when he was living the life that he inspired us to live. And so You know, if I were his biographer, I don't know how I'd finish the book, to be totally honest. So,
that's a challenge.
Yeah. You would definitely have to be eating some really good food when you did it. And
yeah.
Probably just describe it.
Yeah. Yeah, indeed. Well, guys, any last thoughts or anything you'd like to share before we close out?
I think one of my favorite things that I took away, I wanted to share with discovering Anthony Bourdain was his total and complete love of just of food and what food can do. People fall in love over food. People grieve over food. People make big life decisions over food. So many things happen just over the course of eating. And it's such a small and necessary act, like we have to eat to survive. But so much life happens around food. And I thoroughly appreciate it that he wanted to share that with everyone and show it. And that was the biggest and best thing that I will always appreciate Anthony Bourdain for.
Yeah.
I can't say anything better than that.
Yep. Indeed. Well, I know we will continue to live our lives well. We all do things that we're passionate about. And so once again, guys, thank you so much for joining in tonight and for helping us celebrate a life well lived.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All right. Well, we'll be right back with more here on The Random Riff.
Dirty water hot dog. That's what we do. When traveling to New York for the first time, ask yourself what any traveler should ask going anywhere for the first time, especially if they have limited time there. What do they do there that is unique to that place, that they inarguably do better than anybody else in the world? Now, we have a lot of really great, great French restaurants and European-style restaurants here, some of the best in the world. But if you're only in New York for 2 or 3 days, why would you want to do that? What are we the best at? What do we have that you definitely do not have? I'll tell you, we have good deli. We have better deli than you. So I would go to Russ and Daughters or Pastrami Queen or Katz's. I'd get myself a good pastrami sandwich on rye with some sour pickles, a Dr. Brown's cream soda. I'd get a toasted bialy or a good quality bagel with some nice smoked salmon on it and some cream cheese. I would eat some utility pizza. Maybe it's not the best pizza in the world, but it's New York pizza is a unique working class universal experience. I would do that. Dirty water hot dog. That's what we do. Yeah, I like a dirty water hot dog as much as anybody else. It's not the best hot dog in the world by any stretch of the imagination. If I was looking for the best hot dog in the world, I'd probably be looking at Chicago.
Welcome back to The Random Riff. Tonight we have been celebrating the life of Chef Anthony Bourdain. Taken from us far too soon. I knew that when I did this show, this particular episode, that my goal was to not just celebrate his life, but also to find a way to use this platform to help others. Anthony Bourdain's life did end in suicide, and while that will be hard to understand and fathom for a long time to come, it is an opportunity tonight for you and I to talk and have this conversation and find out what are the things that that we can do to provide help for others. And so joining me tonight is a longtime friend of the show, licensed professional counselor Catherine McConnell. She has been on with us a few times, and I welcome her back tonight for what is a very important conversation, and that is trying to wrap our mind around not only the impact of an event of this type, and why it impacts us such in such a strong way, but also, and more importantly, what are the things that we can do, you and I, and for anyone who is struggling, what are some things that we can do? So, Catherine, thank you so much for being on The Random Riff. It's always great to have you here.
Yes, I am always happy to talk to you.
Yeah. I really can't tell you how much I appreciate the opportunity to talk to you, and so much that we can discuss tonight with the recent passing of Chef Anthony Bourdain. When it was when it was revealed that it was death by suicide, I know, as I mentioned earlier in the episode, that I remember exactly where I was, and the impact it had on me was so powerful, because this was someone who I really, really admired and felt I had a connection with. And so I think initially what I'd like to talk about, Catherine, is give us a little bit of insight as to what is it about, you know, some of these celebrity suicides that happen. How is it that we build such a connection with people like this that we don't technically know, but we know, you know, why is this, is there anything to this that you can help hopefully shed some light on?
Yeah, well, I mean, first of all, this is a very real loss, right? A lot of people feel silly when they're like, well, I didn't actually know this person. And I think I've mentioned to you before the term ambiguous loss, meaning it's mm-hmm. it's not the same as if you were to say my grandmother died. People don't view it the same. It's sort of this, it's a loss to you, but it's not kind of thing. It's sort of in between. And I think that makes it difficult to understand, but we do and we don't know these people. So we have this sort of, I don't know, my first inclination is to call it artificial intimacy, but I don't think it's artificial, right? We get to know people mm-hmm. through their art. We get to know them through their contributions, and we know pieces of them, and at the same time, they reflect pieces of us. And I think that's important, and I think that's how we connect. And so it's a huge loss. It's a loss of this person. It's a loss of that medium. It's a loss of hope. There's a lot there. And it forces us to look at dark things that we don't want to look at and in our culture don't really talk about.
Yeah. Yeah, it's one of those things that for me, I know the last time I felt the kind of loss that I felt this past week and still do, frankly, was when we lost Robin Williams. Robin Williams was for me someone who I admired strongly because of my love of humor and wanting to make people laugh. And but I think what both of these individuals, and there's been many others, some were mentioned earlier in the episode, there's those connections, as you said, that we have because we can relate to their experiences. I mean, as much as I love to make people laugh, that was what I was able to relate to with Robin Williams. My love of food, travel, and just living life at its utmost is why I think the loss of Bourdain resonated with me so strongly. We build that personal connection. And I think that's the part of me that was struggling early on with why is this such a powerful, powerful feeling of loss? And I'm glad you're able to shed a little bit of light on that, because I'm sure I'm not alone in feeling this way. There's others who are going through similar scenarios.
Oh, yeah. I'm having people bring it up in therapy. It's definitely grist for the mill right now.
Yeah. Yeah, in fact, I was doing some research earlier, and around this time, anytime there is a loss of someone famous, suicide prevention hotlines experience an increase in traffic in terms of callers and people reaching out for help. Which brings me to my next question and next topic of our conversation, and that is, you know, we often talk about, you know, being there for people and encouraging them to reach out. And yet I think what this loss of Chef Bourdain has opened my eyes to is something that was talked about in the earlier segment with Jake and Leslie. And that is that it isn't so simple to say, you know, if you need someone, I'm here, reach out. It's a little deeper than that. And I think you've got some thoughts you can share with us on that.
Yeah, it's a lot deeper than that. I've always found that really strange. Someone who is in this place is dark and desperate and not thinking clearly. And whether or not it's truth, they feel alone, and that is their truth. So expecting someone in that place to reach out, I find very odd. I don't think they're in the place to do that. And I feel like this is kind of where we fall down a little bit, right? Again, with artificial intimacy, Facebook has done a lot of great things for us, but it has also separated us. You know, a lot of these apps and everything else, it has created a laziness about each other. And we're connected in that way, but we're also very disconnected. And it's important if your friend stops showing up, if they look a little sad, call it out. I mean, all I do all day is call out truth. And, you know, I'll say, you know, hey, your facial expression changed. And they'll say, oh, it's nothing. And I'm like, no, it's not nothing. And I think it's important, right? It feels harsh to do that, but just call people on it. No, we're not going to do this I'm okay, you're okay social stuff. What is going on? I haven't seen you recently. You seem a little off. What's going on? I think it's just important to be in tune and to be responsible for each other all the time, not just when we think somebody's suicidal.
Yeah. There's I find that one of the common themes that I heard from people as I encountered them during the week since this happened is a very dear friend of mine may put it very simply that there is a stigma, it seems, that is attached to those who are depressed, those who are possibly suicidal, that it actually creates a fear in them to reach out because they'll be viewed a certain way as weak or whatever the case might be. And that's something that I know I hadn't really thought about, and it really, I'm just going to use the word, it horrifies me to think that someone who needs help would feel, would feel scared to because of what in their mind would be a potential response. How do we, you know, get past, or how do we create a new mindset for opening ourselves up to people who are in need and hopefully changing or helping to change their mindset about reaching out?
Well, I mean, I think first of all, it's just removing the facade and leading by example. We have a lot of social constructs. I used the example a minute ago. Hey, how's your day? Oh, it's fine. Well, my dog just died and I lost my job, but no, I'm fine because you don't really care how I am. Right. So
yeah.
Removing the facade. I know you've seen, I don't differentiate between my professional and my personal Facebook page because I feel like that person is one and the same. I'm very genuine. I don't have a therapist persona versus a regular person persona. And part of that is because I'm trying to lead by example. So if I'm having a bad day, you'll see me post like, man, is it Friday yet? Like, I'm having a rough time.
Yeah.
You know, and I think it's important just to normalize the experience of being human, because what we're doing is we're shaming each other for being human, and that's a little rough.
Yeah. And I think that I would like to think it's unintentional. I think it's, you know, I think about times that I've told people who, you know, I say, hey, how's your day going? And they say, fine. And I sense that there's probably more to it than that. And mm-hmm. I do the old, you know, pat on the back, like, it's going to be okay. You're going to be all right. And, mm-hmm. you know, I can't make up for anything that I've done in the past. And I certainly can't say that it was done with any sort of malicious intent, but it's that sort of automatic response that we, mm-hmm. that we're conditioned, as you said, to give. And I never have I been more hyper aware than in the last few days, because I'm seeking to become a different person in that regard. I don't know if that makes sense.
Oh, it does.
Yeah.
Yeah. We've sort of abdicated social responsibility, right? We've let go of the being responsible for each other, with the exception of offending each other. Like, we're a mess right now, quite frankly. And it's showing in our mental health stuff. But, you know, those are the moments that are important, and it may not, you know, that person may not be suicidal at that point, but that one moment could change the trajectory of everything. Simply saying, you know what, I can see in your eyes that you're not okay. If you don't want to talk about it, that's fine, but I want you to know that I care.
Yeah.
Just 2 seconds of calling it what it is can change the trajectory of an entire person's life. And I think my job is special because I know that pretty intimately. Like, I'm very hyper aware of my words because of the stuff I do.
Sure.
And I think it's really important. Like, really, it's time to be honest. That's really all I think this is we need to quit shaming each other for having human responses to things. We need to quit pretending we don't need each other. And we need to be honest about what we're thinking and feeling.
Yeah. That honesty comes with some needed courage. When we spoke yesterday in preparation for this conversation, you said some things that that we should be courageous about asking. If we encounter someone that is showing signs of potentially making this permanent decision to end their life, there are some tough questions that need to be asked. And if you would, could you share a little bit of that? You know, because it might change the tone and tenor of some of our thoughts. It did for me, because it's a tough conversation to have.
Yeah, but it's an important one. So first of all, I want to somewhat normalize for anybody out there, because I get this a lot. You know, as a therapist, I have to ask that question. Are you suicidal? Yeah. And we ask it at every intake blanket. People are afraid to let me know that they've had what are called fleeting suicidal thoughts, which literally everyone has under stress at some point. And it's not having a plan or anything like that. It's just, man, today's one of those days I'd be better off dead. Well, okay, I guess technically that's a suicidal thought, but it's fleeting and you don't mean it. And it's important to normalize that, because I have people who freak out and go, oh my God, am I suicidal? And they have this whole existential crisis over it. Well, no, it means you're under a high level of stress and you need to listen to that. But that's not the same thing. But that question is so important, and you don't need to be afraid to ask it. Are you thinking about killing yourself? Because if someone is, you're not asking them anything new. And if they're not, you're not going to put it in their head. I think that's the fear is, if they weren't thinking about killing themselves, once I said it, they probably went, oh, hey, there's the solution, which really I find quite silly. But we don't need to be afraid to ask that question. And at the times that I ask that question, I'm always very surprised, because someone who is thinking about it will deadpan tell you, yeah, absolutely, I'm done here. It's, yeah. There's no hesitation, because they are done. And people that aren't kind of look at me like, God, no. So either way, you're going to get the answer.
Sure.
And I think that's important to know, because people are afraid that they're going to ask it and someone's going to say no. If someone is thinking about it, they'll flat out tell you, because there's an absence of feeling there. They've made peace with it. They're ready and they're not worried about you.
Yeah.
You know, and then on top of that, sorry, go ahead.
No, I was going to say, I wanted to comment that I appreciate the frankness with which you're sharing this, because it is something that for me was extremely new in terms of my knowledge and understanding. And so I just keep bringing it, because I know it's going to be helpful to a lot of people.
Yeah, I think the big fear, you're not going to plant the idea. You're not going to cause a suicide. And if someone does die by suicide, that's not on you. Even if you did try to help, it doesn't mean you failed. It just means the situation got out of control. So on top of asking, are you thinking about killing yourself, there are some things you can ask to assess the seriousness of it. And I'm not suggesting everyone become, you know, a pseudo mental health counselor. I'm just, when you ask someone that, let's say they say yes, then what? So you ask them, okay, well, do you have a plan? Do you know when you're going to do this? If they're serious, they probably have a plan. They may even have multiple plans. If they give you a plan, ask them in detail what their plan is. You're not going to make it worse by doing this, and you need this information. So if they give you their plan, then the next question is, do you have access to these things? Do you have these things in your home so that if you're feeling impulsive, you can do this? You know, if the answer to that is yes, then the next question, what do we do about this? So we're somewhat limited, because you can't force someone to get help if they don't want. And this is where it gets a little bit complicated. You can ask them to voluntarily go to the hospital. Quite frankly, a lot of them will. And you can go with them to the hospital and, you know, report what you heard, and then let them go on their way and kind of see them through the process, which is ideal. If they won't go, you can call 911, but police generally won't touch a mental health case. If you're not with them, you can ask for what's called a welfare check. You can call 911 and say, my friend says he's suicidal. He lives at XYZ. Would you please go check on him? And they will. They're required to. if worst comes to worst, there's something called a mental health warrant. It's difficult to get, but you can get it. So there are actually things you can do. And there's also hotlines you can call. You can call the suicide hotline if you're not suicidal, but you know someone who is, and they can walk you through what to do. So just really, again, honesty, just having the conversation with them.
No, very insightful stuff. In addition to that, Catherine, as we begin to wrap up our time, I want to talk a little bit about some information you shared so we can put it out there. And I'll be making this information available on my own social media for others to see. We talked yesterday about the importance of not waiting, that the resources that we tend to be familiar with, such as the National Suicide Prevention Hotline, that there are places that are available for even when you're just stressed out. You sent me information on warmline.org, warmlines to be used prior. Can you talk a little bit about warmlines and give us a little bit of insight into that?
Yeah, so this is kind of a newer thing popping up, and it's not obviously not as well known as the suicide hotlines, but the warmlines are the step before. I'm under stress, I'm not suicidal, but I'm freaking out and I have nobody to talk to. You call a warm line and there's somebody on the other end. It varies warm line to warm line as to whether or not they're an actual counselor. Some of it is peer-to-peer counseling, but it's someone to speak to. And not only that, a lot of times they can point you in the direction of resources. So it's important to reach out before you're suicidal. We think a lot of times of, you know, this stuff pops up and we have these conversations and then we throw the suicide hotline up and we're good. But it's important to reach out to each other before that. And it's important to know that there are resources prior to being suicidal that you can reach out for.
Yeah. The address, the web address is warmline.org, and it'll help you find warmlines in your area. In addition, there's an organization that is called To Write Love on Her Arms. It's a nonprofit that's dedicated to presenting hope and finding help. This is from their webpage for people struggling with depression, addiction, self-injury, and suicide. And they can be reached by texting TWLOHA to 741741, and they can actually communicate with you via text. So, you know, again, I'm learning so much, Catherine. I didn't realize that these types of resources that are pre-decision are available.
Sure.
And I'm glad that, that you were able to share some of those with us.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think they're really important.
Yeah. And please your thoughts on that.
Well, we're kind of starting to get with the times. Therapists are there are text lines, there are hotlines. Many of us even do distance therapy. I don't do text or distance therapy because of the nature of my work. I do really severe trauma, and I can't control a reaction if I'm not in the room with someone. But most therapists who don't do that high level, they do the lower level depression, anxiety. They even offer video chatting for a session. So if you can't make it into the office for whatever reason, we have video chat, we have text lines, we have hotlines, we have chat boards. We're kind of getting with it. We're trying to reach people where they are. So if you can think of a way to communicate, there's probably a resource out there. And don't let cost be a deterrent, because there's a lot of different ways to get help. We have different listings for sliding scale, all of that. It is totally okay to call a therapist. And a lot of times, like for instance, me, even if someone doesn't or can't appoint with me, I don't let go of that referral until I give them other resources. You know what? I'm not a good fit for you, but here's somewhere to go. So it's totally okay to call a therapist, even if you know that's not who you're going to appoint with. We can still point you in the right direction.
Yeah, no, that's great information to have. Hotlines that exist as well, 1-800-SUICIDE or the National Suicide Prevention Hotline at 800-273-8255. Lots of resources. But again, to our point earlier, these resources are in many ways incumbent upon the person to reach out. I think the encouragement I would like to add, as has already been said, is let's reach out and check on people. Let's not just say, okay, if you need me, I'm here. I think for myself personally, the lesson is it may seem like they're strong, or it may seem like things are going well, or maybe I know someone that that is struggling and that is someone who has talked about suicide. I think I've learned the lesson of it's also about reaching out and about making yourself present for them. So my hope would be that this this platform tonight gives us that opportunity to encourage people to do that.
Yeah, we just need to get back to taking care of each other.
Yeah, I think that is the best way to sum this up. Got to get back to taking care of each other. So Catherine McConnell, as always, thank you so much for your insight and your wisdom, and for your just for all you do. I know you have your patients, but with someone like me and those who listen in, I know we always come away from these conversations with a lot more knowledge and wisdom. So thanks so much for your help.
Yeah, thank you for using your platform to have this conversation.
All right. Well, I look forward to future visits from you. Right now, that we're going to take a moment. I'm going to play another sound clip. And this one is going to really resonate as we hear some words from Anthony Bourdain. We'll be right back with more on the Random Riff.
I wasn't in Haifa. I wasn't in the north of Israel. I don't know what that was like. I was in Beirut. In the few years since I've started to travel this world, I'd found myself changing. The cramped, cynical worldview of a man who'd only seen life through the narrow prism of the restaurant kitchen had altered. I'd been so many places, I'd met so many people from wildly divergent backgrounds, countries, and cultures. Everywhere I'd been, I'd been, as in Beirut, treated so well. I'd been the recipient of so many random acts of kindness from strangers. And I'd begun to think that no matter where I went or who I sat down with, that food and a few drinks seemed always to bring people together. That this planet was filled with basically good and decent people doing the best they could, if frequently under difficult circumstances. That the human animal was perhaps a better and nicer species than I'd once thought. I'd begun to believe that the dinner table was the great leveler, where people from opposite sides of the world could always sit down and talk and eat and drink, and if not solve all the world's problems, at least find for a time common ground. Now, I'm not so sure. Maybe the world's not like that at all. Maybe in the real world, the one without cameras and happy food and travel shows, everybody, the good and the bad together, are all crushed under the same terrible wheel. I hope, I really hope, I'm wrong about that.
Welcome back to the Random Riff. Tonight's episode has been a celebration and a look back at the life of Chef Anthony Bourdain. Just a few days ago, we lost him to suicide. And those of us who knew him, and when I say knew him, I don't mean personally, but I mean through his media, knew and know what an impactful life he led. Tonight, as we prepare to close this episode, I just want to share a little bit about my feelings and what this all meant to me. The grief is still very fresh. The loss is still felt, because he was a man who was open about his struggles, his passions, and his desire to show us the world we live in with a blatantly honest lens. He was a man who was viewed as adventurous, outgoing, and strong, and yet we know that he had struggles that were invisible to us. His life was a life well lived. Pain was a secret well hidden, at least to those of us who knew him only through his media. Tonight, we've celebrated his life. I want to thank so many people that joined me tonight. Leslie Jones, Jake Alfred Potter, Bud Monofeld, and our friend Catherine McConnell, who are just a few people who, when all of this happened, when the news broke, I saw so quickly kindred spirits who had been impacted by Chef Bourdain. Tonight, in addition to all of this, I also celebrate something else. I celebrate your life. if you're listening in, or if you know someone who might benefit from what we've talked about here tonight, I want us to always remember that what's important is to value each other, to take care of each other, as was said earlier. Whatever your place in life, whatever your condition, I say to you right now, you are worthy of love, and you're a value to me and others. If you're stressed, if you're in a dark place, I don't call myself an expert, but I call myself your friend. Know that I'll reach out to you, and know, as we spoke earlier tonight, there are places you can turn. You're not alone, although it feels like that's the case. Anthony Bourdain's legacy is one of taking his culinary experience and using it to create an experience far larger than himself. He showed us our planet, the good, the bad, the ugly, the light, and the dark. His courage took him to places that would scare most of us. And he not only experienced those places, he ate there, and he shared it all with us. Thank you for sharing this journey with me tonight. Thank you, Chef Bourdain, for living your life well. Rest now, be at peace, and know that we will all carry your legacy forward. Thank you to all of you who have joined me tonight for this journey. I wish you all peace. I wish you all well. And for the next time that we come together on this show, let's always remember that conversation is what draws us together. Food is what can bind us. But life is what makes us who we are. We'll see you next time.